It's the 25th of June, 1990, and the streets up and down Ireland are deserted. Except for the odd car or pedestrian, everyone seems to have disappeared. A nation hooked to the drama in Genoa watch with huge tension. Paddy Bonner saves, then David O'Leary tucks his penalty away. People begin to pour onto the streets. Cars drive through cities, towns, villages, honking horns, hanging out windows. Ireland is into the quarterfinals of a World Cup. It had gripped the nation like nothing before, and for a country that had found itself in the economic hardships of the 80s, it represented something new. A new decade, a new pride, and a new hope that we could be something more than what we thought we were. It was an incredible journey we could only scarcely dreamt of only a few years before. But now we were living the dream, and for one hot Italian summer in 1990, it felt like we were the kings of the world. This was Italia 90, so grab your bags and your tent, because we're all part of Jackie's army, and we're off to Italy. Hello and welcome to this week's Green Shoots, a history of Irish football with me, Caelan Kerwin, and Gary Spain. As you heard in the intro, we're at Italia 90, where we'll be talking about how we got there, playing in the World Cup, and Gary will be bringing you some of those incredible fan stories that happened along the way, including some espionage in Hungary, the head of the FBI getting arrested and being in Sicily when their much-loved hero, one Toto Scarlatti, scored. Remember to share the show on your social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. We're also available across the spectrum of podcast platforms, including Spotify, Apple, Amazon, YouTube, and much more. And make sure you turn on your notifications so you can get notified when the podcast goes live on whatever platform you listen to us on. And while you're there, give us 5 stars to show us how much you love the show. So, let's get on with this week's show. So, Gary, if we go all the way back to the start before we get to the incredible living the dream moments that we had in Italia 90, we had to get there first, I suppose, as well. So, and that started with qualifiers. And am I right in saying we basically, the qualifiers happened, our next game was basically the next one after the end of Stuttgart?
Yeah, so after we played the Dutch in Gelsenkirchen, our next international was actually the first game in the qualifying in September 1988. We faced Northern Ireland at Windsor Park. Now, it was a tough group. It mightn't sound as tough as it was looking back now, but we were in with Spain. Obviously, there's never a bad Spanish side. Hungary, who had been in the last 3 World Cups at that stage, they qualified for 78, 82 and 86. And Northern Ireland, who had also qualified in 82 and 86. And then Malta, who were the whipping boys of the group. So it was a tough group, but 2 to qualify. Now, it was important that we got in one of the bigger groups because there was only 1 to qualify, or some of the worst runners up missed out in the other groups. So we were reasonably pleased with the group, but it was a tough group.
I suppose if we look at that group as well, I mean, Spain would obviously be, you know, the front runner is the one that everybody, you know, needs to beat type of thing. But talk to us a little about, I know you kind of gave a brief intro, but Hungary and Northern Ireland, where were they in terms of football? Because their recent pedigree for World Cups was pretty good, but that was a couple of years beforehand. So where were they as football teams?
Yeah, so there was a little bit of a feeling, I remember at the time, and it proved to be correct, that both were in a bit of a decline. So, as I said, Hungary had been in the 3 previous World Cups. They had Laszlo Dattari, who was the star player, blonde midfielder, very classy player, lovely on the ball. Northern Ireland had some great, obviously, in the 82 World Cup to beat the hosts, etc. They went to Mexico in 86, didn't get out of the group, Pat Jennings retired after that as well. His last game was against Brazil. And the feeling was that they were just coming into the... They'd kind of gone a bit over the hill. They'd also won two home championships in 1980, 1984, been to the two World Cups, but Billy Bingham probably had to do a little bit of a rebuild. And it was probably a good time to get both of them, but we still had to get past them. But we were fancied, given our exploits in Euro 88, we were fancied to come out of the group with Spain.
Yeah, and it starts up in Windsor Park in September 1988. How does that match go for us?
No, it was a strange game. It was obviously a huge derby match. I thought we were a goal up after 3 minutes. Tony Cascarino, I was the other end of the ground, but Tony Cascarino's header hit the inside of the post and appeared to cross the line. And I know many people swear to this day that it did cross the line, but the goal wasn't given. We did dominate the match. I think it was Anton Rogan took one off the line when Ray Houghton finally got the ball past Alan McKnight. He had the game of his life in goal. But it finished 0-0. We just couldn't get the goal. Jack seemed pretty reasonably happy after the game with the draw. But there was a bit of a feeling afterwards it might have been one that got away, that it was a chance to lay down a marker at the start of the group. This was our first game. Northern Ireland had already beaten Malta at this stage, but that was considered a formality anyway.
What was the atmosphere like? Because I know in subsequent qualifiers later on, the famous night when Alan McLaughlin got the 1-1 the draw up there for us to qualify, but that night, coming in the future, was considered quite a visceral night, quite an emotional night within the stands at Windsor Park. So what was it like while you were there in 88?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I suppose to put things in context, by November 93, it was a very, very, very tense time. Obviously the troubles were still on in 1988, but it didn't feel as tense going up there at the time. There was some comments, there was some singing. But I mean, I remember some Southern Republic of Ireland fans were on the old reserve terrace. The main stand in Windsor Park, it might be hard to describe now, but it had the main south stand had a reserve terrace in front of it. And there were a number of fans who got tickets together or stood together on that terrace. And they started a few chants up in the second half. Now, they were pretty quickly drowned out. But I was up in the old, it's still there in the north stand, in the top deck of the north stand. But I was way down. I had a great view of Ray Houghton's one taken off the line, but I was a long way from the Tony Cascarino one. So my eyesight was a lot better in those days. I didn't need glasses.
So we move on then, and I suppose that our first real test in this group is away to Spain in November 88.
Yeah, and that was a tough night. I mean, Hungary subsequently beat Northern Ireland in Budapest with a late goal, which probably considered bad news for us. It looked a long time like it was going to be 0-0. We went to Spain. We went to Seville, to the Benito Villamarín, the Real Betis Stadium, actually. And we went with a depleted squad. It was November 1988. We were missing quite a few key players. Kevin Moran had to play in midfield. And we held out for the first half. It was 0-0, but we were under the cosh. And once Spain got the breakthrough, it was pretty much game over. And I think, was it Manolo scored first? And then Emilio Butragueno, yeah, who was the star of the time, he got the second goal. And it was game over. And it wasn't, weren't too despondent, given we were missing so many players. And we still had them to come to Dublin. So, I think most people's view of the group was that Spain were going to qualify. Spain were going to come out of it. So it was the other spot up for grabs.
I suppose in hindsight, the fact that Spain were the front runners, they did beat us, but they were also beating the other people that we were trying to leapfrog above to get into that second place position as well. And they played three times three matches and won all of them before we played again away to Hungary as well. So they were kind of doing us a favor by beating everybody else as well.
Yeah, now one of the issues at the time was that these days UEFA set the fixtures, but that's back right, in those days, all the countries got to meet and agree on the fixtures. And depending on your seeding and where you were, you had more influence than others. And Spain and Hungary, to some extent, carved it up that they didn't get to meet until October and November 1989, which actually was a big disadvantage for us. But as you say, Spain, they beat us. They hammered Northern Ireland a month later. They won. I think they came to Belfast and won after that. They'd beaten Malta. The fixture suited them. They'd already racked up 8 points from four games. They were clear at the top. And when we were heading to Budapest in March, but we got a massive, massive bonus before we went to Budapest, because in December 1988, Hungary had to go to Malta. Now, it was a good time to go to Malta in December because it's not as hot as it would be in other times of year. But it was seen to be a formality, but I think if I remember correctly, they led twice and Malta pegged them back. And the game finished in a 2-2 draw, and that was definitely a point dropped. And that was seen as a huge, huge bonus for us that Hungary dropped a point in Malta.
Yeah, a massive result, even just in the grand scheme of things, just for Malta, that would have been a huge result for them.
It was a huge result, a huge shock. Yeah.
And the game then, as you mentioned, away to Hungary then in March 89, are we approaching it from a point of view of just don't lose? Whatever results that we can get in there, great, but just do not lose this match. Are we at that stage already?
Yeah, we were definitely at that stage. And I mean, because we'd only 1 point from two games, it really was a crucial game. If we'd lost to Hungary, we would have been behind the eight ball and we would have been under a lot of pressure. So it was a massive game. There was a massive travelling support. Hungary was still behind the Iron Curtain in those days, so it was a very different country to the way it is now. And there was all sorts of, I can probably tell the story now, but all sorts of political connotations as well, because I had two good friends of mine had moved from college to Munich for work, and I was sorting tickets. They were driving down with another friend, and we were meeting up in Budapest. So the lads arrive on with this absolutely stunning young blonde American girl, and I'm kind of, wow, and which my eyes were a little bit on stalks and all this, and I won't mention her real name, but as I'll explain, I don't think I know her real name. But she was American, living in Munich, working for Radio Free Europe, which was a radio station at the time that broadcast in behind the Iron Curtain in all the local languages. And she had met the lads in some place in Munich, or had been bumped into them or whatever, and heard about the match, and they were driving down and asked for a lift and everything like that. And it soon turned out that she had as little interest in football as she had in the two lads, or indeed in me.
Bumming a lift, was
she? Well, she was bumming a lift, but she was also using it as cover to get in. It was a first time behind the Iron Curtain. And she was actually meeting other people in Hungary. And the following Saturday, the match was on a Wednesday.
Are you saying that you guys perhaps unknowingly were involved in some sort of espionage ring for her to get over to Hungary? Is that what you're saying?
I think almost certainly.
espionage on a way to away days.
Absolutely, the Cold War was in its the height of the Cold War, and actually the following Saturday, seriously, there was a big protest march that she was in some extent. You know, she was back in Munich at that stage, but there was influence that she was going meeting people in the resistance, and there's no doubt about that. And Now, maybe at a low level, she was quite young. I mean, we were all, I was, what was I then? I was 22. She was only the same age as we were, but she would have been at some level, a low level operative using the cover of the game, coming in with a tricolour. And she did go to the match, but she did a few other things as well. So
keeping her cover. That's what she was doing.
Keeping her cover, absolutely. And she went back in the car to Munich with the two boys.
So. Incredible. What a story. We've forgotten all about the fact that there was actually a football match going on now. So tell us about the football match that happened.
So it was absolutely a crucial game. And it was also, it turned out to be a dreadful game. It finished 0-0. We had the better of the game. I remember Paul McGrath having a great chance, but Dattari nearly stole it for the Hungarians late on. Had he scored, it would have really changed the game, or changed the group and changed the outcome. So it was definitely considered a great result. But the reality was, after three games, we hadn't scored a goal. But we did have 2 points, and we had played our three most difficult away games. So we had taken a really tough start with the fixtures, but it was definitely considered a very good point, probably a fair result. Not a great game, but a crucial point.
And it's Spain going and beat Malta 4-0, and that's pretty much them essentially on the way, so to speak, except maybe for another win or two. But Malta comes again, and they bring up another massive result away this time.
Incredible, yeah. In early April, just a couple of weeks after we'd been there, Malta got to Budapest, and they pull off a 1-1 draw. And I mean, I remember actually, I was in England for work. I was with a friend and with the radio on, and the result came through on the radio, and I was kind of, that must be a mistake. And it wasn't. And there was no internet in those days and no way of checking it. So I think it was the following day in the newspaper before I got it finally confirmed. But thinking, wow, that was, and I mean, that was a huge shock. Whatever about getting a draw at home to Hungary, to actually go to Budapest and draw 1-1, that was fantastic. And we owe a huge debt to Malta in that campaign, because they set up the group for us. And any thoughts about, okay, we lost in Seville, we drew in Belfast. We were absolutely set up then at this stage with Spain coming to Dublin at the end of April.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's that match, isn't it, against Spain that really lights the fire of possibility that we could actually get out of this group.
Yeah, so we were in good shape going into the game. There was massive demand for tickets. I mean, We had sold out games in the past, but there was tickets around, and if you really tried, you'd pick up a ticket. This one was totally sold out. Everybody wanted to be there. Terraces were still open, and Lansdowne Road was absolutely rocking that day. And it was the old pitch. It was very bumpy, and Spain were, look, they were a classy side. Michel in midfield, Emilio Butragueño, some really, really quality players. Vasquez, I'm sure he played as well. Manolo, they had some really, really good players. But they really didn't fancy it on a bumpy, bumpy pitch with a really hostile, baying crowd. I can still remember everyone was screaming. I actually remember in the second half, Butragueño was being substituted. It was the star man coming off. And he was kind of walking towards me. I was in the West End. And he was shaking his head, and he couldn't get over. And everyone was just screaming at him, and he just didn't want to be there, and none of them wanted to be there. And we won the game with an own goal, Michel own goal. Frank Stapleton, I think, was claiming it at first, but I think it was an OG. I think it was Ronnie Whelan put the ball across from the right, and he turns it into his own net about 15 minutes in. And it proved to be the only goal. But we were somewhat, there may be one or two long-range efforts, but we were somewhat comfortable. And it was a huge, huge win. And that really laid down the marker and put us in the driving seat for Italia 90.
Definitely, yeah. I just wanted to ask you something about that. You touched on the crowd and virtually a sellout at Lansdowne Road. Do we see the imagination of the country being sparked after Stuttgart? Is this where we see this kind of big because we a lot of the home games that in this campaign we had big crowds at. So like was it sparking the imagination of the country more than it was before Stuttgart, or was this just a kind of a belief that we were going to make the World Cup?
Yeah, so I think I've said it before. The Euro 88 was won for the football people of Ireland, but Italia 90 was for the whole country. And this was, it was our first game in Lansdowne Road. Remember, we played friendly against France in about February 1989. That had to be played in Dalymount Park. Now, that was sold out as well, and there was big demand for that, but it was still only a friendly. But this Spain game, it just captured the whole country. Everybody was talking about it. It was huge. It was the first big game, first competitive home game in over a year, actually, because we hadn't played a competitive home game at all in 1988. So it was a massive game. Everybody wanted to be there. The crowd were really up for it. And I mean, there had been a lot of talk in the 70s into the 80s that we were missing the Dalymount Roar, that moving to Lansdowne Road to the bigger stadium, to a lot more seats than terraces. You know, there were seats on both sides. The terraces were just behind the goals. That you were losing the atmosphere. You were losing the passion. You were losing the noise. Well, I think if any game dispelled that myth or that story, that was the Spain game that day, because the atmosphere was absolutely electric. It was really, really rocking. And it was a great day and a great win. And that really, I think everyone believed after that we were going to the World Cup.
Yeah, and the subsequent games against, because we kind of reeled off three in a row really in the group, which was against Spain, Malta and Hungary. And it's that period that kind of essentially defines the group really, isn't it? Because we get three wins on the bounce, and that's huge, and it really sets us up for the group. And that game, we win 2-0 against Malta, but it's the game against Hungary that really just is so, so important.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, there were three wins, as you say, in about a six-week period. The Malta and Hungary games were successive Sundays. I'm pretty sure there were Sundays, the end of May and start of June.
That's right, yeah.
So we beat Malta comfortably enough, 2-0. It was really expected to beat them, although they had obviously done us big favours against Hungary. We lost Frank Stapleton through injury, and was it Ronnie Whelan? Somebody was suspended. I think it might have been, I can't remember, sorry. Somebody was suspended as well by a stupid yellow card. So we lost a couple of players for the Hungary game, and the Hungary game was basically seen as being pivotal now. And if we said it was must not lose in March, it was definitely a feeling it was must not lose. The feeling was Hungary had to come to Dublin and beat us. And if we could get the win, we would more or less be putting them away. First half, totally on top. Paul McGrath put us ahead. Goal finally came. We were much the better team. But it all changed after the break. He made a couple of changes, and they really pushed us back. They had some great chances. We were under pressure. And the second goal, with about 10 minutes to go, was a real breakaway. I think Ray Houghton got down the left-hand side. He appeared to push over the Hungarian defender, and the ref waved play on, and he crossed it over, and Tony Cascarino stuck it in the net. And with 10 minutes to go, the crowd just went nuts. And that was it. I mean, that was the third win in a row. We hadn't conceded a goal, and that would have put us on 8 points. We were about 3 points ahead of Hungary. They still had to play Spain twice. And we were in, and Northern Ireland were virtually gone at that stage as well. And we looked in really, really good shape at that stage, at the end of the 88-89 season, as it was then.
Mm. You mentioned at the start that kind of Spain and Hungary kind of carved up the kind of schedule a little bit for their own kind of advantage. But it turned out to kind of be Hungary's Achilles heel. I know you can turn to the Malta games, but playing Spain so late when you absolutely need wins was just kind of really went against them.
It did. I mean, it's great if you can pick up the results, but I mean, the concern on our side was that they might have agreed two draws or a win each, and it would have suited, you know, that. But I think us beating Spain was the crucial thing as well, that it just kept Spain in touch, and they still had to fight and still had to have something to play for. But we had two games left, Northern Ireland at home, Malta away, and we knew actually after the Hungary game, we were guaranteed to qualify if we won both our games. And the Spain-Hungary became academic at that point.
Yeah. We play Northern Ireland then at home in October 89, and it's 3-0. Is that a fair kind of reflection on the game?
Not at all, actually. It was a very nervy one. It was very, very nervous. I suppose there was some talk of Northern Ireland having a faint chance. Now, they had lost at home to Hungary the previous month, when a draw would have suited us a lot better, to give Hungary a little bit of hope. They were a point behind us, but they'd only the two games against Spain to come. So we had Northern Ireland at home, and definitely with a win, we were there. It was a very, very nervous first half. Northern Ireland were missing a couple of players. I think George Dunlop, the Linfield goalkeeper, had to play in goal because they were missing a couple of keepers. But they played really well for 40 minutes. Ronnie Whelan put us ahead slightly against the run of play. But after that, we got two goals very early. That was about just before halftime. We got two goals early in the second half. And the last half an hour was a party at that point. It was 3-0, and we're just singing, we're going to Italy, que sera, sera.
Yeah, absolutely. And is it Malta is the one that secures it, or is it the win against Northern Ireland that effectively puts us through?
So the win against Northern Ireland effectively put us through, because we'd no floodlights in those days. We were playing in the afternoon, and Spain-Hungary was on Budapest that night. So I remember I was driving back to Galway. I worked in Galway at the time. And if Spain had won in Budapest, we were through that night. It was actually mathematically guaranteed, if I remember correctly. And Spain, if I remember, were 2-0 up, and we're trying to get updates on the radio, and it wasn't shown on TV from what I can remember. But Hungary came back to snatch a draw. So it did leave them 2 points behind us with an inferior goal difference. And they were going to Seville and we were going to Valletta. And we needed a draw to be sure.
Ideal situation, really, isn't it?
Well, absolutely ideal. Absolutely ideal. And I think, if I remember rightly, the Malta game had to kick off in the afternoon. And the FAI insisted that Spain-Hungary kick off at the same time. Now, UEFA in those days, they didn't always enforce it. But I think if countries insisted on it, and it didn't go down well with Spain, because obviously they were going to get a far smaller crowd. And I presume the game was in Seville. I think they nearly always played in Seville in those days.
Yeah, that's right.
So the Spanish were insisting there was going to be no funny business or anything. They were already through. But, I mean, they were actually 3-0 up at halftime. The group was done. One of the things about Malta, there was a lot of the fans got stranded in the fog. There was a fog in Dublin Airport. So quite a number of...
I remember reading fans about that somewhere. Yeah. Did they get stuck in Malta for days or something, or what happened?
No, I don't think they were stuck. They were so the flights were stuck in Dublin Airport, and they weren't able to take off.
Oh, so it was going out to Malta. Sorry,
it was going out to Malta. So there were fans arriving in with 10 minutes to go in the game and everything, and it was done and dusted. It was a relatively straightforward game. John Aldridge actually had been on a long scoring drought. I think he hadn't scored in 20 games or something. He got both goals. He got the goal in the first half and he got a penalty in the second half. It was fairly straightforward. I mean, Spain, as I said, were 3-0 up, I think, at halftime. It was done and dusted. I mean, we qualified by 4 points in the end, but it was a formality.
It was a really good campaign by us, though, in all fairness. We were only a point behind Spain, we were 4 points ahead of Hungary, and we only lost one game in the whole group. So it was a really good campaign by us.
Absolutely. Really, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, we won our four home games. We scored, what, 8 goals, didn't concede any. And Spain were the only team to score against us. And that was against a depleted Irish side. So, yeah, it was a really impressive, it was a great campaign. And we were going to Italia 90 with a lot more optimism than we were going to Euro 88. I mean, this was certainly a feeling we were going to do something in Italy. This wasn't going to make up the numbers.
Absolutely, yeah. Although all that might have changed when people saw the draw and the teams that we got stuck with in the group stage of the World Cup. When the draw happens, I suppose, first of all, tell us who we got and what was the feeling afterwards when it was known who we were going to get.
Yeah, it was a big disappointment. I mean, you see, back in those days, there was a lot of speculation, which was absolute rubbish, that they were going to put us in the big stadium. So Ireland are going to come with so many travelling fans. They're going to put us in Milan or Rome or something like that. Now, I mean, a draw is a draw. They don't fix the draw to put, and certainly they don't fix the draw for us, with all due respects. We had the same thing in USA 94 at all. They're going to send the Irish to Boston. We were going to be in whatever group E, you know, and it was never happening, right? Yeah. So the feeling was, well, everybody wanted to be in Northern Italy because Milan or Turin, the big stadiums that had been easily accessible. So we were, now what the one thing they did fix for that draw was they changed the seeding. So Belgium, based on a very complicated ranking system, England would not have been one of the 6 seeds, but there was a lot of concerns about hooliganism at the time. And Group F was on the islands. The seeds were in Sardinia for the 3 games, and the other games were played in Sicily. So the feeling, it appears that FIFA changed the ranking ever so slightly. So England just went ahead of Belgium. I think it was Belgium, if I remember correctly. And it was a bit of controversy at the time, and everyone knew why they were doing it. So England ended up as a top seed. And then, of course, they were immediately seeded in Sardinia to keep them off mainland Italy, away from the Germans.
Put the English lads out on the islands, was it?
Well, we might be joking, but that was definitely a fact. That was the truth. That's why they did it. And it definitely was the group to avoid. I mean, nobody wanted it. Nobody wanted them. And we were, I was disappointed. We were disappointed because it also made the logistics of going to Italy a lot more difficult. I mean, instead of just getting a flight to Rome, a flight to Milan, I can't remember where else you could have got direct flights to in those days. You were trying to get to Sardinia and then you're trying to get to Sicily. And I mean, most of us were getting out in Atlas. Where the hell is Sardinia?
I hope you like boats.
That's what it was, you know, and getting the Dutch in the group as well made it a really, really tough group. I mean, obviously, even though they'd won Euro 88, they hadn't done enough to be a top seed.
Was there a little bit... I know it's excitement to be in the draw for the World Cup, etc. But was there a little disappointment that we had gotten England again in the group, and that, you know, you go to a World Cup to kind of play different teams, and we've essentially ended up playing the two teams that we ended up playing, yeah, in Stuttgart.
Oh, it was. I mean, I think we were the only group with 3 European teams, you know. So it was, and I mean, it was a tough group. It was a tough place to get to, and it was teams if you'd got Brazil or Argentina, you'd say, right, it's a really tough group, but wow, that'd be fantastic. Really looking forward to it. But you're getting England, you're getting the Netherlands, and Egypt were a bit of an unknown quantity at that stage. They hadn't qualified for a World Cup since, I think, it was 1934 that was their previous tournament, and we didn't know too much about them. But it was seen as being a really, really tough group, and the fact that it was so awkward to get to Sardinia and then to Sicily, it was a disappointment. I mean... We were so geared up for the draw, and I remember being really, really disappointed. And kind of saying, oh, this is a shame. You know, I wanted Brazil in the World Cup. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Talk to us a little bit about the prep and trying to get there. First of all, I mean, the draw happens, you kind of figure out where matches are going to be played. So like, how do you, I mean, again, we always say on the podcast, but there's no Ryanair. So you have to figure out how on earth you're going to get from Ireland to the Southern Mediterranean, trying to figure out how you're going to get to, first of all, to Italy, but then to these islands.
Yeah, so it was, I mean, there were direct flights. So there were direct flights to Rome, and then you figure it out, check out. If you go from Rome to, I think it's Civita Vecchia was the name of the place. It's the port of Rome. It's maybe an hour outside. So we decided to take the car to drive. And again, I met the car in Rome. I flew to Rome because holidays and work. Now, I was 3 years in the job at that stage, so I had more holidays, or maybe I was able to build up holidays and plan for the World Cup. But so it was a car ferry. So I flew on the Saturday, if I remember. Italy were actually playing as I was arriving. I didn't get to see the game, but I was getting the updates. Yeah. But it wasn't the opening game. But so I'd watched the opening game at home or in Galway the previous night. That was Cameroon shocking Argentina in the opening game. But the hosts were playing on the, if I remember correctly, it was the Saturday. And I think it might have been against Austria or USA. I think it was against Austria. Maybe Czechoslovakia. Mine's gone a little bit on this one. But Italy got a late goal to win it. And we were kind of vaguely aware of it. I'd arrived, got in from the airport. It was on in the bar. We were able to check the results. And then we were driving to get, I think we got a ferry. Yeah, I don't think I actually stayed in Rome. I think we might have got a ferry in the small hours of Sunday morning. The match, we were playing on the Monday in Cagliari. And we got the ferry to Sardinia and then had to drive most of the island to, and we had a campsite in Cagliari, which hosted the game. I think that's the capital of Sardinia as well. So we had a campsite there, Irish and English fans mixed in together. And it was very handy, actually. We were in a tent. My dad had gone on a trip in a nice hotel, which was actually through the hedge from the campsite. So it was very nice because we were sneaking through the hedge and with our swimming togs. And I mean, I actually knew some of the other people. My dad was with a friend of his from Limerick as well. So we were, you know, we were using the pool.
Yeah.
And they got, they in the hotel, they kind of just assumed they knew us because, well, I was with my dad as well. So it was, so we got the facilities of the hotel, but we were back into the tent for the night.
Glamping for Italian 90, was it?
Well, glamping might be a fancy word for an old two-man tent, but the weather was very good at the time, so camping, and obviously I was a lot younger, so I didn't mind roughing it a bit, but it was great. I mean, it was lovely just enjoying. I don't think we saw, I can't remember what games would have been on the Sunday. I don't think we saw any of the games on TV on the Sunday, and the game then was Monday night. The game was by no means full. So a lot of Irish fans decided to skip the England game. They were concerned about hooliganism. Hmm. The logistics of going to two islands was a lot more than trying to get to one. So, you could save a week's holidays because, if I remember rightly, we were playing England on the Monday and the Egypt game wasn't until the following Sunday. So quite a few fans gave the England game a skip, but there was still a huge Irish crowd there. And I talked about the fantastic weather. It was beautiful, sunny the whole time. And during that game, I think it came during the game, suddenly from nowhere came some horrendous downpours and thunderstorms and everything. And luckily, we were in the lower tier and we managed to get back under cover and we didn't get too wet. But some fans got absolutely destroyed and soaked.
Yeah.
But and big game, went to goal down early on, Gary Lineker, and we huffed and puffed a bit, and with, what, 15 minutes to go, a long ball from Paddy Bonner, Steve McMahon miscontrolled it, great player with Liverpool in his day, and it fell to Kevin Sheedy, who was as sweet a left foot as anyone who's ever played for Ireland, and he drilled it into the bottom corner.
And I know, I kind of feel like that goal gets overshadowed because obviously what came later, but it is it's a cracking goal. I mean, it's a superb strike to equalise, isn't it?
Absolutely. Oh, he caught it beautifully.
Beautiful, yeah.
And it went in sweet as a nut. And it was a great goal, but it was also crucial goal. Because had we lost the opening match, we really would have been behind the eight ball. We would have been in a lot of trouble in that group.
Hmm.
So now, many people talk about it as being one of the worst World Cup games of all time. I honestly don't remember it being that bad, and particularly with the equaliser, maybe is colouring my judgment. But it was a crucial win.
I think
crucial draw.
Yeah, crucial draw. It might have felt like a win. But a lot of people felt that England were going to be out for revenge, essentially, for us beating them in Stuttgart, and this was going to be a really, really tough game for us to come out with anything in the first place, really, weren't they?
Yeah, they were. I mean, they were out for revenge as well, because, I mean, they had been humiliated 2 years earlier. But also the feeling was, I mean, a lot of people going into the England game in Stuttgart were kind of hoping for the best and fearing the worst. Whereas in this game, there were a lot more confidence. They felt we felt we could match them on equal terms, that we had really improved as a side in those 2 years. And because they had had such a bad Euro 88, they were coming in with reasonably lower expectations. Bobby Robson was under incredible pressure as manager. He was going to be gone after the World Cup, and he was getting terrible abuse in the tabloids. So it was probably a different England going into the tournament as well.
Yeah, and we had actually had a good kind of run-up as well. We had five friendlies. We hadn't lost any of them. We'd beaten the Soviet Union. So we'd actually had some like good friendlies in the run-up to as well. So there must have been a good feeling in the team that we could go and, as the song says, go and compete.
Absolutely. Oh, yeah. And I mean, I think most people, myself included, expected us to at least get out of the group and to reach the knockouts. And so there was a lot more confidence around the side. We built on from Euro 88. We'd had a really good qualifying campaign. So we long unbeaten runs as well. As I said, we'd done really well in the friendlies in the run-up. And I mean, we'd drawn with France, drawn with West Germany as well in the friendlies since the Euro 88 as well.
Mm.
Beaten Malta, you know, in another friendly, drawn in Turkey, if I remember rightly, you know.
I wanted to ask you before we move on as well, because I just remembered it as I mentioned it there, the song, the going to the World Cup song, Put Them Under Pressure, probably the greatest World Cup song, Team World Cup song ever of all time, I would say.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think, if I remember rightly, there were about five or six World Cup songs at that stage. I mean, my own favourite is actually Michael Carwood's The Boys in Green from Euro 88. And that was reissued for Italia 90. Ole, 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 Put Them Under Pressure. Of course, you still play it all the time. Fantastic song. There were three or four others as well. I mean, I had all the cassette tapes and we were playing in them, the car driving up and down Italy. And it was fantastic times. Windows open, music blaring. Great. They were really great days, and there were you'd bump into so many Irish people everywhere. There were just so many had traveled, particularly when we got back. So we actually went back from Sardinia back to the mainland. A lot of fans actually took a catamaran or something? There was a boat from Sardinia to Sicily, and thankfully we avoided that one because I believe it turned out to be a nightmare. Some people were stranded at sea and everything. Yeah. It was there's some horror stories from those trips.
So we draw with England. Is it fair to say that I know Egypt probably is a bit of an unknown quantity, but is it fair to say that we kind of felt that we probably should win against Egypt?
Yeah, I think they were. I mean, they actually drew. So after we played England, was it that night or was it the next day? Anyway, well, I remember watching the Netherlands.
Yeah, they played the Dutch the next day.
They drew 1-1. So I remember watching that on TV. And we're a bit taken aback that they got a draw, but felt that the Dutch missed a load of chances. We certainly would have been expected to beat Egypt. And the big thing would have been said, if we beat Egypt, we'll be on 3 points. And it was the top, because it was a 2014 World Cup with 16 going through, the top two were going through in each group and the four best third place teams. So the feeling was, if we beat Egypt, we'll be on 3 points. And that'll pretty much guarantee you get out of the group. So you kind of feeling is get one draw and one win and you'll get out of the group. And we were expected to beat Egypt. They were an unknown quantity, but we should have beaten them. We were expected to beat them. And it changed. So
did we play like we should have beaten them, or was it a bit of a dour 0-0?
Oh, it was a dour. I mean, look, what they did, they parked the bus. So they absolutely parked the bus. They said, come and break us down. It was a Sunday afternoon. We just never got going. We missed a few chances. We dominated the game. We just couldn't score. And
gave us a bit of our own medicine, did they?
They did. And I mean, I think famously, Eamon Dunphy was... We heard back home that he'd gone nuts at the TV studio. I think he denied. I don't think he actually said he was ashamed to be Irish, but it was said that he said he was ashamed to be Irish. And there was a lot of shenanigans went on. But it certainly was a massive, massive disappointment. When that final whistle went, it kind of felt like we've blown this and we're out of the World Cup. You know, we've definitely messed up.
So England draw with the Netherlands then. So the Netherlands have drawn with Egypt. They've drawn with England. So we've got to play them now. Am I right in saying before the match starts, there's no guarantee of either side making it through because obviously England have to play Egypt. So we're still in kind of like in limbo land as we go to play the Netherlands.
Yeah, we probably felt, okay, we might need a win now or at least a draw, and a draw is hope with a draw. We were, I suppose, fortunate that it was the last game in the group, but it also depended on how England-Egypt went. Hmm. And so you could have had, I mean, every group game at this stage had already ended in a draw. So, but certainly the feeling was, if someone wins, you're through. And we went a goal down early on, which was a huge blow. Mm. And that was, it felt like we were on our way out. Mm. You know, but the first half, the Dutch were pretty much in control, had chances to get a second. And we had the odd chance, but as the game went on, it was really, and it wasn't great in those days in getting world through. So I don't remember being aware of the England-Egypt score. I may be wrong on that. I can't recall now for sure. But it certainly wouldn't have been up on the big screen and, you know, you wouldn't have got it on a radar. You know, no internet, obviously, no phones. So 15, 17 minutes to go. It's not looking good. Feeling a bit desperate. And it's another Paddy Bonner long clearance. another assist goes the length of the pitch. Dutch defender misjudges it, and Niall Quinn sticks it in the net, and we just go absolutely nuts. We go nuts, and that was, it seemed to come from nowhere, you know, and it was just desserts from having been so close to knocking the Dutch out in Euro 88 and reaching the semi-finals.
I don't remember the goal fully, but I think the ball comes in. I think the keeper spill it or it bounces awkwardly or something like that, and Niall manages to get there ahead of him.
Yeah, so Niall, if my memory of it is the Dutch defender, I can't remember his name now, misjudged the long ball, and then it kind of became a battle between Niall and the keeper. We'll have to look it up on YouTube to get it right, but Niall just got his long leg in front of it and steered it into the net, and Bedlam. What a crucial goal.
Huge goal. The last few minutes of that game, is it, are they aware of what's going on in the other game with England?
Yes.
Because I remember there's a bit of controversy in that we both teams kind of just kind of went, right, if you keep the ball, I'll keep the ball. And they just kind of didn't really do anything for the last 10 or 15 minutes.
Yeah, so I think we definitely, after we scored, we became aware. And I think we were told wrongly that England were 2-0 up, but they're only 1-0 up. So, but it is a bit controversial, but it's certainly for the last 5-10 minutes, both teams appeared quite happy to keep the ball and play out the 1-1 draw, which did guarantee both of us going through. Now, had Egypt scored, it was only 1-0. It could have all been different at that point. But it there is a story that Mick McCarthy and Ruud Gullit did agree to play out the 1-1 draw.
Should we say unsubstantiated in case any solicitors
unsubstantiated,
get involved?
Unsubstantiated, yes. Okay.
but it's a mission accomplished, though, isn't it? It's get out of the group, a group that we thought was very, very difficult.
So, yeah, we got out of the group and we'd actually finished. So England had won the group by beating Egypt. We'd actually finished joint second with the Dutch. And they actually had to draw lots live on TV. So, and I remember we were trying to get from the stadium in Palermo back to the station. I think was the road closed or something? And we had to get a train. Because we were driving, I think we drove for the Egypt game. Anyway, we ended up back in the station in Palermo and managed to see the drawing of the lots on TV. And we came out as the runners-up, which meant we went to Genoa to face Romania and the Dutch went to Milan to face the Germans. So they did miss. I mean, I think we were happy to get out of the group, but certainly Romania was a far better draw than actually facing Germany and Milan, which would have been a very daunting task in the last 16.
Romania were kind of similar to us, though, didn't they? They kind of squeezed through on 3 points, and that was good enough for them to get through.
Yeah, so we actually, on our route, so we'd come back to, not realizing we'd be seeing Romania again, we'd come back from Sardinia back to the mainland, and we'd actually gone down to Naples to watch Argentina, Soviet Union, and gone over to Bari and seen Romania, Cameroon, and Roger Mia. So Romania, I think they lost to Cameroon. Roger Mia beat them that day, but they squeezed through anyway. Whatever they squeezed through, well, I think they finished runners up. Did they draw with Argentina and beat the Soviets?
They drew Argentina and they beat the Soviet Union in the first game, which must have been, for obvious political reasons, must have been huge for Romania as well.
Oh, so. Absolutely. Yeah, it was huge because, I mean, they didn't have that many fans there, but they were certainly very, very virulently anti-communist at that stage. They had lived through the Soviet oppression.
Absolutely, you know? Yeah. Ceausescu and those terrible regime as well. So we're through the group. We find out that we're playing Romania. What's the feeling about this team, Romania? Because they're a half decent side, really, aren't they?
Oh, they were. I mean, they were a really decent side. I mean, it was going to be a tough game. We're probably seeing it as a 50-50 game, but also as a winnable game. You know, I mean, I think had we been facing West Germany as it was then, it would have been a really, really tough task, maybe a bridge too far. But Romania was seen as maybe 50-50. We had a good chance, but they had really talented players. Georgi Hagi was known as the Maradona of the Carpathians, and he was one of the best players in the world at the time. And they were a really, really good side.
Arguably, probably one of their greatest players of all time, Georgi Hagi. Well, not arguably.
It's certainly right up there. I mean, they obviously they had great heroics in the USA 94 as well. But he was a top, top player, and that was a very good Romanian side.
So Genoa is the scene. How did you exfiltrate yourself to Genoa back onto the mainland?
So, well, I suppose the good thing was, it's always, for me, I couldn't come home without the team. And same that would go to any tournament. I would always have made plans that if I'm not staying for the whole tournament, I will make some kind of allowances or make some way of staying on or getting holidays. And I had other complications with 2002. But for Italia 90, it was my first World Cup, and I planned to stay for the whole tournament anyway. So the only tickets we actually had going out to the World Cup were Ireland, England, and the final. So the final was actually an easy ticket to get. But the FAI were holding up. Back in those days,
I love these stories, because it's like, oh yeah, just turn up on major tournament days and get a ticket or whatever. And you're like, yeah, I got a World Cup final ticket. Whereas today it would be like gold dust floating in the air.
I mean, for next year, I'm not even going to try. It's just going to be impossible. But anyone could apply to the FAI in 1990, same for Euro 88. And it wasn't that hard to get a ticket for the final. We applied for both semi-finals. And that's another story that I got really lucky on. But we'd applied for both semi-finals, but the FAI had decided to keep all the knockout tickets and use them to swap and exchange. And if I remember rightly, I don't know where, I must have been down at the beach or something. So we were looking for the Naples. So we had decided we're just going to go to the Naples semi-final, unless obviously we were in it or whatever. And we'd been asking the FAI for tickets, and my father had been on to someone in the FAI and everything. And he couldn't find me. And he said, okay, this is before the Dutch game. The FAI decided to offload the semi-final tickets. And there is a definite story there, because so before they offloaded the semi-final tickets, they said any of the fans wanted them. So if my dad had found me, I'd have said, I would just take Naples. But he found Paddy, and he said, Osh, we'll take both. And so we took Turin and Naples. But there might have been, had we actually beaten Italy, there might have been a real controversy on tickets. But I'm sure they would have found tickets from somewhere. And obviously, had we beaten Italy, the Italians wouldn't have wanted to go anyway. But it was very different in the tournament in those days. I mean, we could rock up to Naples, we could rock up to Bari without a ticket, buy a ticket on the day. We rocked up to the day before the game in Genoa. We rocked up to Brazil, Argentina, and got. And there's another story there. That's
two of the titans of world football.
Well, I mean, this actually sounds ridiculously stupid, and I will say I was totally stupid in this. We had a long drive from Sicily up to Genoa, right up the whole length of Italy, and we were deciding and spent a long, long time discussing, should we go to Brazil, Argentina, or Germany, Holland? Now, I'm looking back 35 years on. It wouldn't even take me a nanosecond to make the decision these days. But we took a lot. And I mean, one of the things was, the feeling was, oh, it'd be easier to get a ticket for Brazil, Argentina. We arrived in Turin and there wasn't a ticket to be had. And all the touts, another story was the ticket touting was done by the mafia. So let's not put to find a word on it. So we arrived at Brazil.
Espionage and organized crime. What do you do at these games, Gary?
I'll tell you, the stories are far better from those days. So we arrived, and the touts were for £300 and £400 at the time, which was just crazy money. And we were very early, we were walking around the stadium, and who do we see? Only Louis Kilcoyne, who was the president of the FAI at the time, but a hugely controversial figure, because he'd sold Milltown, and Mary Hunt, who was the FAI's interpreter. So she said, look, have you any tickets? We want to go to the game. And we had Irish jerseys on and everything. And he says, I've 400 tickets, 300 or 400, I can't remember the exact number, but lots of tickets. But I'm trying to swap them with the Argentinians for tomorrow's match. And I said, please, will you just keep two? Will you keep two? And so he says, I'll see what I can do. When he disappears, we followed him back. And we picked up a bit of a crowd at this stage, because there was a lot of people looking for tickets. And he disappears for about 20 minutes into the bowels of the stadium. And we're sweating. Hopefully we get, because that was our only chance to see the game at this stage. So he comes back out and says, the Argentinians don't want the tickets. I'm stuck with the tickets. Category one, well, whatever. Category two with this price. I'm going to sell them all. So he was selling them at less than the category one price. So there was still, in fairness, I'm no fan of his, what he did to Milltown, but he was not a ticket tout. He was actually trying to offload the tickets at less than face value. But he was selling the tickets, and I said, we'll take two category ones. He agreed to take a euro check. And with her,
I had the ticket check.
Well, no, he did. He took a check, but he, because, I mean, we were trying to watch the money at that stage as well. He did kind of know who we were. And I said, look, he would have known who my father was from Limerick and football. So it wasn't, and I mean, obviously, we're going to honour the check and everything. So it wasn't as if it was a total stranger and it was somebody Irish, right? But he did agree to take the check, which was handy because we were watching our cash and everything. And we can worry about the check when we get back to Ireland. So he'd handed me the tickets. I hadn't even finished writing the check and he was arrested.
What?
And the touts, Louis Kilcoyne was arrested at the World Cup in 1990 for ticket. This made the newspapers in Ireland. He was arrested for ticket touting. but he wasn't actually touting. So he spent the game in a police van with his 298 tickets. I was the only one. We got two tickets from him. I hadn't even handed over the check. And I gave the check to Mary Hunt, and she put it into her bag. And she was just in shock that they'd taken Louis. And it made headline news back home. So I was the person that he was allegedly touting the tickets to, but he was selling them for less than face value. He was just offloading the tickets.
You find yourself in the craziest situations. How do you do this? for the love of the game, Gary, for the love of the game.
Absolutely, the love of the game. And so we got to see the game. We got to see an incredible game. And Maradona's pass to Caniggia. And Argentina put Brazil out of the World Cup, and Brazil had dominated the game, just couldn't score. And it was a real smash and grab by Argentina, but a fantastic game to be at, fantastic atmosphere. And I still can't believe we actually considered going to Germany, Holland instead.
Neither can I. So you get yourselves, am I right in saying it's not that far from Turin to Genoa?
They were quite close. So we had I think we'd actually ditched. Yeah, we didn't camp after that. We ditched the tent at this stage, and I
sleeping.
We started getting hotels and stuff, or getting cheap hotels and staying. It had become a bit much. I don't think we camped. I think we stayed somewhere down the coast from Genoa. So we'd gone there, we'd gone to Turin. It might have been an hour and a half's drive. And then we were back near Genoa for the game the next day. I can't remember the town we stayed in, but it was maybe 15, 20 minutes down the coast from Genoa. Pretty sure we got a cheap hotel. I don't remember camping after that. And we did try a bit of crisscrossing. So I think that was, we had decided, probably on the way up, that the camping was done and we had had enough.
Enough of that.
Well, it is. I mean, it's not. Look, I know they had good campsites, and they'd have showers and stuff like that. But it's not been that pleasant in a tent. And you could pick up cheap hotels, especially in those days. Yeah,
I suppose after, when you get into the knockout phase as well, you have a lot of fans that have gone home as well because their team is out, etc.
So, yeah, they have. Yeah.
So you kind of, the herd is thinned a bit.
It is, and I mean, it was. I think the cost. I mean, definitely, we were saving money in the campsites, but it probably wasn't massive money or anything like that. No, look, we had a great time. We were eating well and everything. We weren't skimping on. We weren't going to McDonald's. We were going to nice Italian restaurants and having
proper
good
food.
No, just proper food. Oh, we were. I mean, the food was fantastic. So you wouldn't go to Italy and not go in. No, it was local trattorias, but local. in small towns that were really proud of their food. And I mean, I'd recommend to anybody, if you go to Italy, to go to these local restaurants run by local people. They're so proud of their food. They're so proud of you coming to their restaurants and drinking local wine, really good quality and reasonably priced as well.
Yeah.
So it's one of the things kept about, away from McDonald's. Yeah.
It's one of the, and thank God you did as well, because you probably would have missed a lot if you did, because anybody that, I know we're digressing for a bit of this, but food in Italy is like, it's a religion, really. It's a gospel.
Yeah.
Every single town and every single village and every single countryside place has their own unique little thing that they're proud of, whether it's the wine or the cheese or the ham or whatever it is. They take great pride in the food that they have in their area.
And it is. And I mean, it's more of a matter of pride than trying to make money. And they're just so proud that you'll go in and you'll eat their food and you'll... So we had Italy was absolutely amazing. For that month in the summer of 1990, it was just absolutely amazing to be there. Now, I would concur with the late, great Con Houlihan, who said, I missed Italia 90. I was in Italy at the time. Because I certainly missed everything that was going on at home, but we had an amazing month in Italy. And amazing food, amazing wine, and the atmosphere was incredible. And I mean, I was gutted when the draw was made, but as it turned out, I was delighted to go to Sardinia and then go to Sicily. It was just fantastic to be there in those islands and be among the people. And I should actually go back to Sicily, because one of my memories, we stayed in a place called Cefalù, which is about an hour from Palermo, and one of my best memories of the World Cup is standing in the square in Cefalù with Irish and Dutch fans and the locals watching Italy and watching Toto Scilacci, the son of Sicily.
Oh, wow.
And he was a legend in Italy, but he was a god in Sicily. And watching him score for Italy and just standing in the square watching the big screen and the whole place going nuts and everyone and... They just adored him, and I mean it's Maradona levels in Naples. It's Toto Scilacci in Sicily. He was there. I mean, he was their talisman. He was the talisman for the whole country, and he was obviously we'll go on and talk about him in Rome.
We'll talk about him. Don't you worry about that.
To be in Sicily when he was scoring, up in Rome, obviously, but to be in Cefalù watching at the game with thousands of people going absolutely nuts, and that was special times as well.
Absolutely incredible. I would imagine that was absolutely amazing to be in that square. But we're in Genoa. Is the feeling that we're not quite sure how this is going to go, because Romania do have some great players, but so do we. So is there a feeling that, you know, this is going to be really close, or that this Romanian side could turn it on and we could be in trouble?
Yeah, so I mean, it was seen as more of a 50-50 game, I think, from my memory was. And one of the good things was everyone that wanted a ticket got a ticket. It was a big enough stadium. We were the only ones there. Romania had very few fans. Now, unfortunately, a lot of fans did have to go home after the group stages. They had planned to go home. They'd booked home, and it would have been very expensive in those days to come back out. But some fans did come out then that maybe decided not to go to the islands, came out for the knockout. So there were reinforcements coming out. The stadium, the atmosphere was incredible. It was on a Monday evening, I think around 5 o'clock local time. And stadium wasn't quite full. There were gaps, but nearly everyone there was Irish. And the atmosphere was just absolutely electric. But it was a 50-50 game. Could have gone either way. I don't remember it being a great game. There was not much in it. It was 0-0 after 90 minutes, 0-0 after 120. A lot of tension there. And
I think kind of once it got into that kind of extra time period, though, wasn't it? It did seem like both teams were kind of in it not to lose, not to concede. So there's a bit of a... Both teams were still kind of going for it, but they realized that, you know, it was better to try and maybe sit it out a little bit and not be too overly exposed. So there is a bit of to and fro, but not too much happening.
Yeah, I think both teams, it was a case of must not lose rather than try and go and win this. Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair comment. And it was all down to the penalty shootout and the nerves of that. So,
and I know there's been many votes and on what the best sporting kind of moment is for Ireland, but time and time again, it's this penalty shootout that just hits number one every single time. It is like the focal point. It's one of the great sporting moments, not just in Irish football, but in Irish sports history.
I think it's Irish history, actually. It's not Irish sports history. I mean, literally everybody watched the game. I tell the story my American colleague told me when I got home. He had been, and at the time, it's trying to explain, but at the time, there would have been, the Cold War was kind of coming to an end, but there was, the threat of nuclear holocaust was still considered somewhat real, okay? So it was, I'll frame it in that context. So Chuck was working in Galway, working away, and the match was kicking off at 4 o'clock Irish time. And basically, everybody took a half day or left early. So Chuck was working away, finishing, hadn't taken note at the time, had no interest in sport or certainly no interest in football. And he kind of packed up at 5 o'clock and walked out. And there was nobody around. And he thought it was very strange. So he gets to security. And we're working for an American multinational. And security was very, very important in those days. There was nobody at the security desk. And he walked out. And then he got really, really, really scared. And he thought something seriously has happened. And he genuinely thought there had been a nuclear holocaust. So he sits into his car and he drives. He was living in Salt Hill. He was working in digital at the time in the Merview Industrial Estate. He had to drive right across Galway. And there wasn't a single person or a single car on the street. So then he was absolutely convinced. And he was just said, I was praying to get home to die with my wife and daughter.
The end of the world.
End of the world. It was he didn't see, he said there wasn't a person or a car in Galway. And he drove right across Galway, burst in the door in an absolute panic. And his wife and daughter were watching the match on telly. And I mean, there's photographs of O'Connell Street in Dublin, which was just empty. Well, nothing ran, no buses, nobody did anything. You could have robbed any shop you wanted, but there was no police. There was absolutely, the whole country stopped for the World Cup. And that's why, I mean, I joke a little bit about the late, great Conor Hoolan. It was a brilliant line because those of us who were in Italy, only kind of getting to find out over the phone or what, the country had changed, had stopped. But everybody was watching in front of a TV for that penalty shootout. And there's nothing can grip the country like Ireland in a major football tournament.
And drama always seems to follow us at nearly every tournament as well. What's it like being there in that situation? Because when you're at home or you're at the pub, it's you're surrounded by people that are watching it, but they're disconnected from it in a way. Do you know what I mean? You're in that moment. You're seeing this moment happen in front of you. All those penalties are going in. Every time somebody steps up, do you just go, Mother God, what's happening here?
Even as a fan. And the other thing, actually, my seat was right down almost in line with the goal line, but at the other end. So I was hoping the penalties. But if you actually look at the photographs, there's a massive stand behind the goal, which was all Irish. So they were the lucky ones that they had a fantastic view. So I was looking down the pitch from quite a long way away, but still, it was just fantastic to be there. But it was just so nerve-wracking, just so nervous, the tension. And the worst thing was they went first, which kind of piled the pressure on. And of course, Georgie Hadji is up first and he sticks. And from what I remember, and I'd have to watch it back, it could prove me wrong on this, but they took four very good penalties. The first four Romanian penalties.
That's right, yeah.
Were very good. A couple of ours, Tony Cascarino's just scraped in.
That's right.
So yeah. we got to 4-4 with a little bit of luck. And then, well, famously, everyone knows Daniel Timofte stepped up and Paddy Bonner made that incredible save.
It must have been incredible to see him save that, because there must be a split second in your mind where you're kind of going, geez, he's going the right way here. And you know, it must have been like that incredible kind of freeze frame moment where you kind of go, oh my God, it's going that way.
Yeah, and then we went nuts. You know, it was incredible, you know. and then there's the massive, massive shock. How the hell is David O'Leary taking a penalty? Because David O'Leary was a cultured centre-half. I don't think he'd ever taken a penalty in his life. And he was one of the last men you'd have expected on that team. He'd only come off. He'd been out of favour with Jack Charlton.
That's right,
he'd only come off the bench, I think, in extra time. Was it Steve Staunton or somebody got injured? And he would never be one of the people you talk about to take a penalty. But boy, did he have the bottle and some bottle to take. Not only to take a penalty, take the fifth penalty. And of course, he sent Silvio along the wrong way. And that was
hysteria.
Absolute nuts, you know.
I remember the kind of, he scores, he falls to his knees, he puts his head on his hands. You know, all of these kind of the moments after have become, you know, ingrained in our memory with so many photographs and so many videos watching all the time. It was incredible. But what always stuck, the image that always stuck to me was there was a shot of a pub, I don't know where it was, or someplace, and people were going ballistic and crazy, and there's this elderly gentleman right in the center of the shot, and he's bawling his eyes out. And it kind of brings home to, like, I know we laughed about it the last podcast, but like, you know, like this kind of 80 years of just complete pain, and all of a sudden two come along at the same time, and we're doing it. We're making ourselves look good. We're doing ourselves proud. We might not be playing the most electric looking football, but we're getting the results.
We were in the quarterfinals. I mean, we just went nuts in the stand, but we were in the quarterfinals of the World Cup. You know, and I mean, it looked incredible.
Yeah,
it was just dreamland at that stage. You know, to get to the knockouts and then to actually win and get to the quarterfinals was just really special. So,
it's amazing when you think about it. Like it. You're three wins away from winning a World Cup. I mean, I know they probably, you don't think of it that way, but like, I know it's very simplistic to think of it that way, but like, that's how close we came, was like, you know, to getting there.
Yeah, and I mean, who knows what could have happened, you know? We were a good side. We were really tough to beat, and who knows, I mean, what could have happened had we equalised against Italy. I mean, jump forward to the semi-final, but I felt the pressure. Argentina beat Italy in that semi-final, albeit only on penalties. But Italy had been much the better team, but just, if anything, the pressure got to them, the pressure of the home crowd, and maybe that could have happened in Rome in the previous round. Who knows? It wasn't a great Argentinian team in the semi-final.
No,
had we got that far?
It wasn't, but we got to a quarter-final in Rome then 5 days later. What's the feeling ahead of this game? Like the biggest game in Irish football to date?
Yeah, so it was huge. I mean, it was a huge game, and it was just fantastic. I mean, we'd actually planned to be in Florence that day watching the other quarterfinal. Obviously, had to change our plans. But, and I mean, then there were so many Irish. So a lot of fans did have to go home from Genoa. I mean, because they you have to turn around and go, people were going home overland and that they'd get back to work and everything. Mm. The Italy game wasn't until the following Saturday. So luckily we were planning to be in stay in Italy anyway, so it was pretty easy to change. We didn't even have a hotel in Florence anyway, but it was pretty easy to change your plans from Florence to Rome. And there was huge, I mean, there was plenty of Irish around Rome. There was huge hype, huge expectation. There was a mass airlift then as well. So the travel agents managed to charter flights after flights to get fans out. But the other big concern then was tickets, because we were playing Italy, the hosts. So Italy beat Uruguay that night. So after we played Romania, we went to watch Italy, which kind of expected to win. They did. There was going to be a huge, huge scramble for tickets, because we were entitled to so many tickets, but suddenly the world and his mother won. I mean, it was a good friend of mine flew out on the day trip. There's so many people came out on day trips. And
They came out on day trips, as in?
Day trips, yeah.
Out in the morning, back late at night?
Back late at night. There's worse than this. Say they came out on day trips from Dublin and Shannon and wherever. Joe Delaney, who was the treasurer of the FAI, they were allocating the tickets, and there was no real system. You just had to queue for tickets. So one couple had said, so he was there and they joined the queue and they reached it where they were getting tickets. In the end, I think everyone more or less got a ticket. There was tickets pulled from wherever. So they said they were sitting watching the Romania game and they just had to be at the Italy game. And he said, you took an awful risk coming out from Ireland with no ticket just to fly out like that. We didn't come from Ireland. We came from Sydney.
What?
They were in 1990 at flight prices. They were watching the game in Sydney, an Irish couple, and they just said they had to be there, and they booked two flights to Rome. Arrived in Rome on a Saturday, it was a Friday morning, and flew back on the Sunday. Wow. They went from Sydney to Rome for a weekend. And
that's incredible. That's dedication.
But it's dedication. But there were people coming from everywhere. I mean, they just wanted to be there. I mean, in some ways we were, I mean, I remember sitting in, we were 3 weeks into the World Cup that day, that stage. We'd spent a lot of time in tents. We'd been kind of washing clothes and sinks and stuff like that. I probably wasn't a great sight. And there were guys coming in behind us on the day trip on brand new. I mean, I know, I think Paul McGuinness was there. He's the U2 accountant and everything. He was in seats near us. There were other great and the good. Some people coming in and spanking new rugby jerseys or brand new Irish jerseys. We were the scruffy ones that had been there for 3 weeks. But
real fans. We're the real fans, Gary.
Well, absolutely. So it was
the game then. How does it go for us? How do we play? Because this is. It's a huge game for them. It's a huge game for us.
Yeah, it's a strange one. I mean, we played reasonably well. And I mean, the only goal was Packie had a great tournament, but it was a mistake.
It was a mistake, yeah.
I think it was a Donadoni shot. I think it was Donadoni had a shot and he just parried it out. And look, Toto Scalacci, he was on fire in that tournament. It was a fantastic finish. We had chances. We had a go at them. Remember John Sheridan had a free kick and everything, but it just wasn't to be. It just felt like, but it felt like if we could have got the goal, if we'd gone into extra time, who knows what could have happened.
Hmm.
And
them at home, as you say, you know, them at home as well, under that huge pressure, the expectancy of winning the World Cup.
Yeah, it was. And I mean, I expected them to win the World Cup. Certainly their home fans demanded they win the World Cup. And I think just the expectations and the pressure probably just became too much, but they did deserve to beat us. I mean, I don't think we could have drawn, we could have taken them to extra time or penalties, but probably the better team won. But there wasn't a huge amount in it, but there was also a huge feeling of pride, just being so proud of the team and everything they'd done, and to have gone so far. And we certainly went out with our heads held high.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to you about, I suppose, on the night. the villain of the piece, which is Todos Galachi. I mean, I suppose in time we kind of came to kind of endear him really to us, because there's a very kind of symbiotic kind of story there between, I suppose, us and him, and both us in terms of, I say us with the team, the Ireland team, and him. We just had like this crazy, heady summer of our lives, and it was just an incredible time for him and us.
Yeah, I mean, I actually don't. I mean, I know there was T-shirts with FU whatever Scalacci. I mean, I honestly don't see him as a villain. I mean, he broke our hearts. There's no doubt about that. But he was doing. I mean, he didn't cheat. He didn't do anything wrong. He was doing his best for his team, and he had a fantastic World Cup. And I mean, what a player! What a goal scorer he was. And I mean, he took his goal very well. So I certainly don't see him as a villain. And he has become subsequently a cult hero and everything. But he was, to me, he was never the villain. I mean, he's the guy who scored the goal that beat us in the World Cup quarterfinal. But it was fair and square. He was playing for Italy. And look, but he was, a legend. And it was a goal for Sicily as well. And I mean, there's strong feelings in Sicily that they feel neglected, not wanted by the rest of Italy, and suddenly they had Todos Galachi, and I mightn't be explaining very well what it means and what it meant to them, but he was their god, and he meant so much to Italy in that tournament, but in particular he meant so much to Sicily.
Yeah, absolutely, and it is that kind of mainland island or kind of mentality, isn't it? You're not part of us. You're kind of out there, but you're not really one of us. And Sicily, of course, is notoriously kind of, I suppose they'd call themselves independent, or I don't know what way you'd call it. Probably the equivalent of Cork or something in Ireland.
A lot of Northern Italians make comments like that's Africa or something like that, you know, which is really derogatory. And it wouldn't go down well in Sicily, you know. So to have suddenly the talisman of the national team being a local boy, it meant so much to them. It really did.
Yeah. I actually saw there, just by coincidence there, the other day, there was somebody put up a photo, and it was this brand new Todos Galachi mural that had gone up in one of the Sicilian towns as well. So he's not forgotten either. He's always in their hearts and in their minds. He's passed now, unfortunately, but they'll always remember.
Sadly, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. Wonderful player.
So our tournament ends. Our hearts are broken by Toto. Like all the other events, you're not going home yet. You're staying on, but it's a real hero's welcome. It's the country just absolutely stops again for when they come home.
Well, completely. I mean, the figures, I mean, it's in the millions that line the streets of Dublin, you know, for the
homecoming,
the welcome home. I mean, obviously I regret missing it. You can't be at everything, but we were still in Italy for that. But it was, I've seen the videos, I've read the reports and everything, I've spoken to people who were there, and it was a real special homecoming. I mean, at that stage, the team was just adored. You know, it was seen as being a hugely, hugely successful World Cup. And
you said it at the start of the podcast, which was Stuttgart was for the football fans. It was the ones who had kind of suffered along the way with the national team and the heartaches and, you know, all the LOI fans and all that kind of stuff that had come along and all the way. But this was now a national team that had grabbed the imagination of the whole country and changed people's perspective on what the national team could deliver.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, I gave the example of my former colleague Chuck, you know, this was everybody, the whole country. Everybody was invested in the team. You know, I mean, everybody became an expert in football. Many, many people watched their first ever football match in their lives on television for Italia 90. And I mean, you also got some pretty crazy opinions and everything as well. You know, I mean, I remember RT doing that. They did some sort of a panel. They got GAA players who hadn't, some of them hadn't a clue about football, and they were given their expert opinions on it. And everyone was an expert. I mean, we were all experts in COVID, and we were all experts in whatever the latest thing is. But back in the summer of 1990, everybody was an expert on the Irish football team.
Yeah, and it was just incredible. And I know, like, I don't want to kind of say it had an effect like this, but it had come at the right time in terms of Ireland as a country, because the 80s wasn't a great time, you know, economically and stuff like that as well. My own father had to go and work in London and stuff like that. So it seemed to kind of cap off that kind of the decade of the 80s where things didn't go so well for the country. But all of a sudden now there was this kind of like things were beginning to slowly kind of turn around. You know, the things were starting to, I suppose, slowly get better. And that was the kind of focal point for that kind of movement going forward, so to speak. I'm probably not explaining it too well, but it seems, to have that period that coincides with Irish history as well.
I think it did. I mean, there was a sense of national pride, and there was, I mean, the 80s, as you say, I remember the 80s, it was a pretty depressing time. And I mean, okay, I was fortunate. I was able to go to university, get a degree in computer science where there was jobs. But a lot of my friends were unemployed. There wasn't a lot of money around. And this brought a confidence back into the country. And people were walking around Germany or walking around Italy with a real pride in being Irish. There was a huge pride at home. And I think it did give a kickstart to the nation, to even the economy. I know loads of Germans and Italians after these tournaments came to Ireland to visit because of what they'd seen in these tournaments. I mean, the tourism numbers went way up afterwards. And there was certainly, and I mean, even just a pride in the flag. People were, I mean, with all due respect, if you saw someone a tricolour in the mid-1980s, you might be thinking terrorist. If you saw them with a tricolour in 1988 or 1990, it's football fans, the whole country, you know.
I get it, because there's that connotation as well with England fans walking around with a Union Jack at that same time period. You kind of went, maybe stay away from there for a while.
Oh, absolutely. You know, you would be more cautious, you know. Whereas, I mean, it was definitely a case of the tricolour was everywhere then, and I mean, it had consumed the country.
So absolutely fantastic. I suppose for yourself, you got to go see a World Cup final. Am I right in saying that?
Yeah, so we stayed on. We stayed on another week. Got to both semi-finals. Got to see Maradona beat Italy on penalty. That was heartbreaking, actually. Mm. There were so many tears shed in Naples. Went to Turin and saw Gazza's tears, and Germany beat England on penalties. Mm. England somehow had managed to get to the semi-final without impressing, and they could very, I mean, there's another one, they could very well have won that World Cup. I think if they'd won the shootout, they would have beaten Argentina in the final.
All the Italians that overnight became West Germany fans was quite incredible too. They did not show their love for Mr. Maradona after that. Anyway, that's sure, even though he was playing in Naples.
The other irony was that World Cup final, there were tickets openly on sale in Rome.
Wow.
In the run-up to the final for less than face value.
Wow.
You know, it sounds ridiculous now.
Because they weren't in it, you literally could not give the tickets away.
Well, yeah, it was hard to sell. I mean, there were a lot of Germans coming down for it. But, I mean, the stadium was pretty full. But there were guys, I remember, I think the dearest ticket was £135, if I remember. And there were guys begging for £100 for it. You know, there were, and I mean, we'd already bought, I said, we had our tickets coming out. Actually, a friend of mine, we actually made phone calls to friends in Munich. One of the guys that was in Budapest with our CIA agent, but he came down without the American blonde.
Codename Blue,
whatever. And he got a train actually from Munich and came down, and we bought a ticket, so he had a ticket when he got down, and brilliant. People were able to go to the game. So I mean, it was easy to pick up tickets. We were walking around Rome for a couple of days before that final, and anyone that wanted a ticket, I mean, it seems ridiculous now. It's just so difficult to get a ticket for a World Cup final. But and it wasn't a great game, but it was a fantastic occasion and great to be there.
Do you look back on that? I mean, I wonder, because, you know, myself, I've never really been to, I haven't been to a major tournament and any of that kind of stuff. But when you get to somewhere like that and, you know, you go to a World Cup final, etc., do you, are you just kind of living in the moment day to day, etc., or in this passage of time since then, do you kind of look back at it and go, geez, what a great time it was. I went to a World Cup final. I saw these great players. Do you get that at the time that maybe you don't when you're young and you're older now, and you're able to look back at it with, maybe with a different perspective?
Yeah, look, it's fantastic to look back and say, I mean, at the time, you're probably just living in the moment, you know, and it was, I mean, I suppose the cost in getting to the World Cup final would have been things like the flights and stuff. But I mean, the tickets were easier. It was easier to get tickets in general in those days for big events. And so it was fantastic to be there. And I mean, I suppose I was thinking I might never get to another one, but I mean, It was great to be there. And looking back, it's fantastic to look back on that tournament and say, yeah, I was there. I can't believe it's 35 years ago, but it was amazing to be there.
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. Memories for a lifetime, incredible. So next time, I think when we talk about the Irish national team, it's a failed European qualifying campaign. And
one that definitely got away. Euro 92 is one that got away.
Well, we'll have to talk about how that got away in the next one about the international team. But Gary, incredible, thanks for talking to us about not just the matches but your incredible experience there, that I'm sure even Irish fans now would be envious to be looking at and wishing that they had that kind of experience or something back then as well.
Well, hopefully they'll come again. Absolutely, hopefully we'll see them again.
Yeah. All right, Gary, thanks very much. Until next time.
Okay. Cheers. Thanks, Kevin.
Well, that's it for this week's show. Remember to share the show on your social media channels to spread the word about the history and heritage of Irish football on the island. Make sure you turn on your notifications so that you can get notified when the podcast goes live on whatever platform you listen to us on. And while you're there, give us 5 stars to show us how much you love the show. And remember to support your local League of Ireland and Northern Ireland Football League team. It's our history, it's our game. Until next time, bye for now.